Hey everybody, let's have an AA meeting. Well, I bet a lot of you have been to other meetings today, so we're glad you hung in there and came in to see us at 8. It's been a real busy day for a lot of alcoholics not drinking. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story.
Hello, my name is Reese, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. This reading is based on a passage from 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeaker.org desperately in need will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Since I've been in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, God has blessed me with two great sponsors, and one of them is speaking tonight. This lady is God-sent, very spiritual. She's helped me through my storm. I love her. I really do love her. Sometimes I get her mixed up with being my mom and my sponsor. She's always telling me, don't get up. So with that, I will give you the wonderful Linda Lauerman.
Where's the stool? You see my eyeballs? I'm Linda, and I'm a grateful alcoholic and addict. I'm truly an alcoholic. I love the reading before this speaker meeting because the thing that I've done consistently is come to meetings and tell my truth. And no matter how silly I looked or not, I used to come into the rooms and just rock myself, and just because my whole body hurt. You know, this is a physical disease. It's a mental disease. And it's a disease where we haven't fulfilled our spiritual potential. I just sat here and let it happen because that's all I could do first. And eventually, I came out to be able to show my face. I was very shame-based. I hid that from the world for 32 years. That's how old I was when I got sober. So the first half of my life, I'm going to have to wing it because this is what I wrote. The dog that never eats anything ate my homework. He ate the first page. So this is the second page that I retrieved. I guess the first page is in her stomach. She's like this big. So I'm going to tell the whole story. I haven't done that in a long time. I'm kind of nervous about it. And I haven't told my story since I've been back to Atlanta. So here goes. When I was born, around 1, age 1, my parents realized that I had severe asthma. So I was uncomfortable everywhere I went. My grandparents had chickens. I was allergic to the chickens. We went to the mountains. I was allergic to the mold and mildew in the mountains and the wet, you know. When I go to the beach, the sand hurt me, you know. Everywhere I went. And, you know, as I look back on it, I was rushed to the hospital a lot. And they pumped me up with all kinds of drugs to keep me alive. So I was used to this, like, you know, keep yourself alive, and keep yourself alive, and, you know, this adrenaline rush, this back and forth. And plus, I had, like, steroids and a bunch of things. I don't even know what it was. It kept me alive. I'm grateful for that. My body got used to a quick fix. And I got used to putting some in my body to make myself feel better, to make me feel alive. And that was just the beginning. When I was 5, I can remember looking up at my parent and saying, I won't say what I said to myself, but I said, you know, I'm in trouble here. They don't get me at all. I mean, not even in the realm. And I had this, like, mental picture of myself in a suitcase, just trucking, you know, leaving my house. And that was, like, 5. I had an intuition. I knew kind of what I was, and I knew it wasn't them, but I didn't know where my other people were. I knew when I saw the Christmas show with Rudolph, and there's a island of misfit toys, I always thought I belonged there. I wanted to go to that island. And from then on, I just collected misfit people. Because, you know, as an artist now, I know that necessity is the mother of invention. So we are all very creative. If we can create a new life for us, we come in here broken, we got to fix it. We create that life for us, and with the help of every other person in here. You know, you feed me my new life through this program. You know, my father as a kid was absent. He was building a company. And he's told me since that he regrets that. He's 91 now. 92? I think he's 92. and he was pretty critical. Well, let's say very critical. And I was scared to death of him. Just, you know, and he was also, and still is to a certain point, intimately not there. And by that I mean just unable to even look people he loved in the eyes or put his arm around me and tell me he loved me. It took him a long time, I mean, talking like 50 years, to say he loved me. And I just couldn't make heads or tails of that. My mother was busy doing the social thing with him. And I had 2 older brothers and sisters, and they were out, you know, they were doing their thing. But by the time I came along, my dad was getting successful. And so they were, you know, my mom was just like, okay, it's go time. And, you know, she's having parties, and she's just like, okay, you go upstairs, you know. She didn't really know how to express herself either emotionally. She had some depression. And she had a lot of anxiety that came out in different ways, and she couldn't really pinpoint it as anxiety, but, you know, she would have, you know, these panic attacks as she was driving down the road. And she had, like, spatial anxiety, of which I find that I have, too, now. You know, all of these things had her not be able to focus on me, because she was fixing herself. She was, you know, serving the relationship that she, you know, was in with my father. You know, but they did all they could to, you know, run to the hospital and keep me alive and all of that. So, you know, they didn't get along. And they got a divorce, and I was really happy about it. I was just like, finally, you know, they can go on and understand themselves and maybe grow a little bit, because they were stuck with each other. And it wasn't fun. It wasn't fun. So I had my first drink. I don't even know, probably around 12. You know, back then it was real, people drank pretty openly and in the house. My dad had this It was when Coors was just coming out, and he filled the garage with Coors beer because a friend of his had a truck coming down from Canada or wherever it was from, Colorado. And it wasn't in Atlanta yet. So anyway, you know, that was a high school kid's dream. I mean, literally stacks of cases of Coors beer, you know. Man, I had a good time with that. But the first time I drank, I went and bought, because I looked old for my age back then, and I went and bought a six-pack of beer, and I drank one before I went to the party, and with all intention of sharing it with my friends. But I didn't tell them I was going to get it, purposely. And by the time I got to the party, I was hiding it in the bushes. I was like, what's up with that? You know, and I knew at that point, I can remember succinctly, like, I've got a problem. I can't let this stuff go. It's like Oreos. I can't stop eating them. I cannot stop drinking this stuff. And I remember I didn't like the taste at first. I remember in, up in the mountains, I drank some moonshine. And my grandfather would share that with me. He was, a countryman from Georgia. And, that was, I'll never forget the way that tastes, you know. Just burnt my insides out. And I loved it. Like, burn me more. You know, I love that punishment as an addict. And if it has a benefit on the other side, that's even better. You know? So that was high school. And in high school, I share this because addiction is a physical disease for me. And I developed, my first disease was an eating disorder. And when I grew out of the asthma and stopped putting the medication in my body, I grew into eating. And I found myself in the freezer eating gallons of ice cream at a time. And I'm like, oh, and I was a gymnast. I was a good athlete. And I was like, I got to get rid of this, you know. So I threw up. And that was very shame-filled. I was very, very ashamed of that. My parents and my family still think that I hide things from them. And I finally figured out that I was hiding my own shame. And they kept looking at me funny, and like, I would get punished for like things that I didn't really do. And I'd say, I'm telling the truth. I am telling the truth. And, but I wasn't telling the whole truth. I wasn't telling how miserable I was. So I went to, college, and I say that because I went to, I think, six colleges. And, you know, some of them highfalutin and some of them not. I was just trying to finish. But my disease of alcoholism and other disease was kicking my ass. And I did the work. I think I have like 6 years of work, you know, and never graduated. So I finally, I got married. Part of the drinking story is before I got married, I tried to escape my disease by putting a backpack on my back and going to Bangkok. I loved the grit of Bangkok. I loved the danger. I don't know how I'm alive. I know that the part of the police force there took me when I was drunk, took advantage of me. Also had that happen on a date when I was drinking. So they put something in my drink and just left me in this house to wake up with, and nobody was there. But, you know, Bangkok to me, I loved the people. I loved the grit that fed my, you know, alcoholism. But I also love the spirituality there. And they have a way of just letting go. Just like, whatever. And they're driving those tuk-tuks around, and everybody's like crashing into each other. It's like, hey. It was just, it was me at the time. So I kept coming back here and getting more money, and then going back there, and back and forth, back and forth. And my family, I don't know where they were. I mean, they just, I guess, let me do it, you know. I mean, I was 27, I guess. But finally, the guy I was dating said, you either come back and marry me, or it's done. So I was like, okay, I guess this is it. And I came back and married him. And he was my drinking buddy. He was a great, funny, fun guy. And met him on a blind date. And we had a good time until we didn't, you know. I ended up marrying him, moving to Pensacola, Florida. And by the time I was down there for, I don't know, maybe 4 years, we were starting a business. And by the time it ended, I was drinking vodka at 7 a.m. in the morning. And just like crawling across the floor. I remember crawling in the kitchen and opening all the cabinets, trying to, where did I put that? Where did I put that? You know, probably drank it the night before. But I was, my entire body and my life was intoxicated and was altered. And Linda has left the building. Just not there. So when I would get up the courage, I would drive myself to this treatment center down there and just say, check me in, you know. And they would. And I would get out and think I had this thing and drink again. Because my physical was so affected by the alcohol, too. And I was nauseous all the time. And I shook all the time. Not only from the alcohol. So I drive myself back there. I was in and out of the program for 6 years. Finally, I went back to the same treatment center again, and they're like, I don't know what to do with you. I mean, you're doing the steps, you have a sponsor, and, you know, you're all right. And I don't know why you keep drinking. I'm like, I don't either. He said, why don't you go to this 3-month treatment center? And I thought to myself that that was just the end of the world. 3 months seemed like a lifetime. You know, I just made up this whole horror story about it. And I had this card on my desk, this greeting card, and it said, on the front it said, if you don't go in, and inside it said, you won't find out. Mm. And I thought, there's something I don't know. Something I don't know yet. What I found out is there's a whole world of joy and ecstasy on the other side of this disease that is incredible. Mm-hmm. And I just got goosebumps. Because there was a whole world inside that door. And you guys were there teaching me and telling me you can do it. So I went. And I had a spiritual experience there, a big one. I was walking down the same street. I mean, you know, they don't let you go very far. And so there was this one drive that I would walk every day just to walk off some steam. And this tree would, like, bow every time I went under it. And the third time, it bowed when I went under it. And I was like, I wonder if that's God talking to me. I wonder what would happen if I really let go and believed that there was something there that will support me through the pain. And so I went back and I sat with my back against a tree, and I can remember sitting on my hands because I'd heard that in a meeting. If you just sit on your hands, you won't drink, right? So I sat on my hands and I said, God, no matter what, just don't let me drink. I'm never gonna put a drink in my mouth again, ever. And when I got up, first I have to tell you that I wore all black. My hair was black makeup, and I was just like this, I didn't smile. I really didn't know how to smile. I truthfully had to teach myself to turn the corners of my mouth up when I got sober, because I thought my smile was ugly. I was so self-shaming and had a lot of self-hatred. So when I got up from that tree, I felt like doing cartwheels. And like I literally wanted to do cartwheels, but I couldn't yet. Right? Now I do cartwheels, all the way down the drive. But they said, all right, you're good. You can go on to the next phase. Right? So I got through that phase and I went to Colorado. And my first, I've been sober in 3 cities now, Colorado, Los Angeles, and Atlanta. I was in Colorado for 5 years. And my first sponsor was tough gal. Big tough gal. I was scared to death of her, so I asked her to be my sponsor. And she was a big book thumper. And we were talking every single word in that big book we read. And she explained it to me. And I went to her apartment in, I don't know where. It was a dark side of town. And I was kind of scared going up into her apartment. But I wanted it. I didn't care. I needed the freedom that she displayed. And, she ended up running the central office in Denver. I think she's still there. But I learned a lot from her. I learned a lot about the steps and about the big book especially. Let me see. So, let's see, how old am I? I just got sober? Yeah, I just got sober and moved to Denver. So I got a divorce because I realized that I married my drinking buddy and I didn't even know who he was. And he hadn't really found out who he was. So, and I was really exploring. And I needed somebody to explore with me. Or I couldn't stay sober, I didn't feel. Nothing about him. I just needed a different type of person in order to stay sober. So I got a divorce and I was just sitting there completely empty. And I said, God, what am I supposed to do with my life now? I know I'm not supposed to be a housewife. So what next? I'm sober. And, my life was so empty and my heart was so empty that I could hear like a pin drop. I could hear the message, and it was fashion design. And I was like, what? I do not want to deal with women, and I'm so fat, and, this doesn't look good on me, and all the pomp and circumstance and the runway shows and all that. I was like, that is not me. Not me. But I had to listen because I didn't have anything else to listen to. And I went back to school, my 8th school. And didn't graduate for that one either. But I did most of it, just a couple of classes I missed, and found out that I had a talent that was in my family. My great-grandmother was a head couturier at Maison Blanc in New Orleans. And so I came by it naturally. That's what God was telling me. This is what your gift is. You can sculpt. You can make things that express, that help people express who they are. And you can make things that make people feel good. And that's what I wanted to do. I didn't want to follow trend. So to kind of start out my career, I had an internship with a fashion designer in Los Angeles. And I went just for the internship and ended up staying 20 years. breaking into AA there, finding all of the meetings and meeting new people and all of that, it was hard. It took a lot of energy. But I did it, you know. I'd drive around in circles for an hour to find some meeting at 10 o'clock at night if I had to. Because I was determined to find my spirituality and find out who I was. So, where am I? So, Los Angeles. I went to meetings at this one place every Saturday. And we had a little family there. And we supported each other. And Michael came and joined me there. And we had a really good time. It was a time of freedom, a time of discovery for me, and I just let loose, and it was great. Lots of other people were doing the same thing, and so we helped each other. Being in the program in a place like Los Angeles where people think it's, you know, circus and everybody's, you know, just worried about how they look, it's so opposite of what the town is, that we just really got to create a new force to help all of us understand who we are and what we're there to do. So about, I don't know how many years in, a couple of years in to L.A., I was discovered by a woman in Italy who asked me to come and design in Italy. And I went there and I showed in Paris with Dior and McQueen and those people. I did the show and I was, you know, of course, low man on the totem pole. Nobody knew my name with Adam. So it was really, really grueling. You know, they are, it's a tough business with tough people. And, but I did the show, and after my Paris show, I was just in tears. I was like, this is not it. I can't do this and stay sober. It's too much energy. And I thought, you know, well, I should be grateful. It's like, look what God has given me. Look what sobriety has given me. Look what you guys have given me. How can you do this? So I went back, and I was like, I don't know. You know, I went back to Italy. And it's a lot less glamorous than it sounds. You know, I was staying in a cot, basically. Couldn't speak Italian. Didn't have any friends there. And I was just producing with this team of Italians. So I remembered seeing some bamboo in the show, in a fabric show. And I thought, you know, that, no pesticides. And that's antibacterial. Maybe there's some meaning there for me in fashion. Maybe I can take this fabric and help people understand that that being green and being sustainable means that you're beautiful. So I started developing fabrics around bamboo and soy and milk fabrics. You know the stuff, like if you sit a cup of milk on the counter too long and the stuff rises to the top, that white stuff, that's called casein, and it's a protein, and they make fiber out of that. So I thought, this is what I'm going to do. So I packed up everything, and I came back to L.A. because I knew that I needed my support to in order to launch something like that. No way I could do it, you know, against the forces of the fashion industry in Europe. So I came back and people got behind me. It was pretty awesome. And with some other people, we created a new area in sustainability called Luxury Eco. And met celebrities and Robert Downey Jr. launched my men's line. And, I asked a friend of mine in AA, I was like, what do you think people want to know from me? They're like, and he said, what celebrities you met? I'm like, really? that was a part of it. And people appreciated it. And I came to it, honestly. And they felt that from me. I believe that when we get sober and we start feeding our heart with what we do, no matter what it is, mm-hmm. that people come. Build it and they will come. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter what it is, you know. So if you're being a barista, be the best, most spiritual, kindest barista you can be. And it is rewarding internally. So years and years went by, and I found myself through what I did. I started, you know, creating images that were about getting sober and how hard it is to get sober and that feeling. One was called Fierce Heart before fierce was a word. And it was this image of this just like red beating heart with the veins of a tree coming out of it. And it was about through fear and through hard times, we get through it to nature and to our spirituality. So those types of things. I did a line about, it was called the Hope Series. And it was about sustaining the craftsmanship of tribal people, keeping, you know, where they come from alive and telling their story. So as I had a stage, I started to want to tell other people's story, you know, and that came from the program. You know, I wanted to help other people. So I gathered all these stories to share. All the while going to meetings, and yoga was a big part of my life in LA. It really helped my anxiety, and I went to yoga AA meetings. You know, LA is real, like, they'll make up a meeting around anything, you know. And there's always a cake and clapping, and everybody's on stage and presenting themselves, and, you know, it's hilarious and a lot of fun. And different from, you know, some other cities I had been in. Denver was pretty I guess dark, kind of, is what I think of AA in Denver. But intense, and I learned a lot. I think people go to Denver to break out, break through, and grow. And I saw that over and over again. And in Los Angeles, people go to kind of discover and maybe fall and come home. So I ended up working too hard, and I got too thin, and I wasn't eating, and I got severe anxiety. I was losing my house. I was losing my business. I was losing my love. And the anxiety was too much to handle. So I went to this doctor. I got a few minutes, but I went to this doctor, and he gave me a pill. And he didn't, I said, it's not addictive, because I talked about my sponsors, and in L.A. I have two sponsors in L.A., and they work in partnership to keep me sober. And I still call them, and I travel with them now. We're good friends. They gave me a pill, and they said it wasn't addictive, and so I'm like trusting this guy. He's a brain surgeon turned psychiatrist, and turns out it was addictive. And I went back to him. I'm like, this isn't working. You know, it worked for about a year, but it wasn't working anymore. He's like, take another one. So I'm like, huh? So of course, you know, I'm running and going and not really paying attention much, but what I'm doing, my mission in life. And I take another one once, and I felt high. And I'm like, damn. You know, this stuff, this is addictive. I don't know why he said it's not addictive. He's the one that should know. But so I called a friend of mine that I knew was addicted to pills, and she's like, mm-hmm, that's addictive. And I know, my God. So I had to go somewhere to detox off of that. And I was taking it as prescribed, but I can't get off of it. You know? And so I checked myself into a place for anxiety and depression, and they also detoxed me off of that little thing. When I checked in, when I did the P test, it wasn't even in my system. I was taking like a you know, speck of it, trying to get off of it. But it still had me. It had me physically. And when I got off of it, I felt like I was like, you know, walking on the side of a mountain. It was the strangest feeling. That stuff is no joke. When I got to Atlanta, because I had to close my business, and I got back here, and you know, I realized that my body, I had really trashed my body in sobriety. That my organs were starting to shut down, and I didn't even know it. Because I had such strong will to do what I wanted to do, to create what I wanted to create. You know, and to make a difference in the world. And I didn't care about my body. I never did. Really didn't care about myself, you know. I just wanted to create, like my dad, you know, be successful, like my dad. And so for the past 3 years in Atlanta, I've been getting my body back. Like 3 years ago, I couldn't walk from my living room to the kitchen. Because of how I abused my body in sobriety and didn't even know it. You know, because it's a disease of denial. And when we're sober, we can be in denial too. And we can be delusional. That's why we have sponsors that know us, know our way of thinking, and can say, oh, wait a second, that's all right for like 2 weeks, but not for a year. Right? We got to stop this. I'm going to hold your hand, and we're going to stop this now. And that's what sobriety is about. I did a lot of walking when I was feeling in trouble, when I felt sad or just that anxious feeling inside. The minute that anxious feeling would come, I'd head out the door. I'd just walk. Sometimes I'd walk for like 4 hours. Just walk. Until it went away. That was my meditation. Anyway, I think that is coming to the end. And Nava has been really important to me because I can sit and just be myself and not have to look like anything, be anybody. I can just absorb what you guys have to feed me and get better. In sobriety. So I thank you for all the love and the family here. That's my story.
Thank you, Linda. She may have said it, and I may have missed it. It's moving around the room some of the times. Her home group is the 8 o'clock Tuesday newcomers meeting here in this room. We're real happy to have her working with other alcoholics here at NABA Tuesday at 8. Okay, next Monday, Joe Jay of the Fifth Tradition Group is going to tell his story. We had him scheduled about 3 weeks ago. He had to go out of town. He had somebody take his place who owned a yoga studio. So we're hearing a lot about yoga and AA these days. Joe, great guy. So come back and see him next Monday night.
Okay.
All right.
Time to receive the message of being free. Give me some time to breathe. It's not that I don't want to see. Understood your words to go ahead and forget my world. Oh, and I surrender, since even darkness could be a light. Oh, and I remember that all the dreams I made. And I tell myself not to cry. I feel like a long lost child.